welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And welcome to our special romantic Valentine's Day edition of True Crime Tuesday, Tim.
Aww.
I know we're a few days early, but you know, I thought we always talk about weird, dark stories on here. What if we just found a good old-fashioned love story, Tim? Just a good old-fashioned love story that we could talk about.
Oh.
And unfortunately, I just couldn't find one of those that didn't end horribly. And I mean,
well,
horribly.
Especially for true crime, I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was in New Orleans a couple months back doing the Wizard World convention.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to do an investigation, a little paranormal investigation with our buddy Bloody Mary. And she starts telling a story about the location we're in after we've had a chance to walk around this location, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really weird because we go in, and my friend Greg Lawson, we've had him on our show, the paranormal detective.
Mm-hmm.
He goes up and walks right into the bathroom and stops and stares at the bathtub for some reason. I walk up and I stop directly in front of the oven, and I just keep staring at the oven, and I couldn't put my finger on what about it was going on. And then afterwards we went downstairs and Mary said, you know, it's interesting, most people get pulled to those two places. And I said, why is that? And she began to tell me a very, very bizarre story. And I thought, no, this can't be true. So I looked around. There was really only one book on the subject. And from my understanding on it, the book portrays the victim as though it's kind of her fault. And I thought, no, we're not going to victimize the victim in this sense, you know, turning it on. Oh, yeah. What happened? She brought on herself. She knew who she was dealing with. No, there's never an excuse for the kind of violence and horrific nature of what went down. So I was like, you know what? I need to know more about this case. So I reached out to a good buddy of ours and I said, hey, good buddy, there's this case. And he said, okay, I'm intrigued. And I told him, and I said, would you do some research and join us for True Crime Tuesday in a month or so? And he said he'd love to. And I think within about a few hours, I got a text back from him. I was like, holy hell, I am uncovering some weird stuff, Dave. And this story, Tim, runs in many different weird levels. So joining us, our good friend Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer and psychic explorer, is back. He is world-renowned fourth-generation science-based evidential psychic medium who communicates with spirits. He is the author of the critically acclaimed Amazon and spiritual bestsellers Never Letting Go and Evidence of Eternity. But we're bringing him on because of his legal expertise. Mark's credentials and experience are unparalleled in the paranormal world, of course. And he's also an Oxford-educated trial attorney licensed to practice before the United States Supreme Court. In England, he studied mediumship at the prestigious Arthur Findlay College for the Advancement of Psychic Science. So he really has a unique perspective to the otherworldly versions of these stories and the law. And I gave him the title. And he was in it to win it. Mark Anthony, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be back on the air with you and Tim.
I love that we can give you a case that there's information about, but nobody has comprehensively put it together, at least not in a way that we feel comfortable talking. I know I can let you loose and you will dig deep and find the information on this. So today we're going to talk about what is reported as Katrina's final victims. And this, of course, is after Hurricane Katrina. It takes place in New Orleans, and a gentleman that is known as the Katrina Cannibal Killer. Mark, I tell you this story. I ask you to go after it. At any point, do you ever, when I call you with these cases, do you ever go, maybe you should find another friend, Dave?
No, because first off, I love doing the investigation and the legal analysis on these. And in my legal career, I did cross paths with a couple serial killers. There was one, and then before we get into the Zach and Addie love story, there was this guy named John Brennan Crutchley, and he was in Florida. He was known as the vampire rapist. And what happened was he would abduct women, drug them, and then he would drink their blood and rape them. And he abducted this one woman, and apparently he left her for a while, and she was a pretty tough woman. She was, I don't know how to say this diplomatically. She used to ride with motorcycle gangs. Okay, so she knew her way around a fight, and she managed to get out a window and was found running down a street naked in Palm Bay, Florida. long story short, the police went ahead, raided his house, found all of his equipment. But it got even deeper because when they executed a warrant on his office, and he worked for a defense contractor, and the guy was a computer whiz and an engineer, brilliant guy, they found a woman's driver's license in the drawer of his desk at work, and it was a woman who had been missing for some time in the state of Virginia. And the more the evidence was coming out, it appeared that he was more than somebody who drank people's blood, that he was actually a serial killer. And it, five decapitated corpses of women were found within a quarter mile of his house, but there was no direct evidence linking him to those. And at the time, I was working for this law firm, and they were talking to him about possibly representing him or working on his case. And I'll never forget this. I had this older boss, and he was a real character. And my boss, he was 65, and his wife was like 25. Okay, I mean, it was, you know, one of those things. And his wife's mother hated him. So they're bringing the vampire rapist into the courthouse. And my boss goes, "Hold on a minute. I need to give him my mother-in-law's phone number." Well, you can imagine that didn't go over very well in the courthouse, but it was something I'll never forget. But that's just one of the times that I've come into contact with people of this nature. And it certainly is a very unique and intense genre of people to deal with.
This case is so disturbing on many different levels, and that even once this case is over, another case kind of unfolds. I mean, when you start to unravel this mystery and story, is it not just one of the most I want to call it freakishly coincidental, but it is definitely a disturbing tale that continues to repeat itself.
It really is. I mean, you know, first off, it's set in New Orleans, and you've been in New Orleans, and I'm sure Tim has, and I've spent a lot of time there. And there's a lot of paranormal enthusiasts in New Orleans, and this story actually exceeds anything even Anne Rice could have come up with. I mean, you have Zach Bowen, who was the boy next door. You know, he was the jock in high school. He went into the military, married, two children. You know, he was the quintessential all-American boy. But it appears that while he was in the military, he saw and experienced some pretty heavy-duty things, and it appears that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So when he comes back to the States, things didn't work out with his wife. They separate. He moves to New Orleans, and he meets Addie Hall. Now, Addie, she's working in bars. She's a bartender and a real popular girl. And Zach and Addie meet each other, and from all accounts, they seem to get along really, really well. And when you brought up earlier, Dave, that they call him the Katrina killer?
Yeah, the cannibal? Katrina, yeah, cannibal killer, yeah.
A cannibal killer. What happened was Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, which was an absolute disaster. And Zach and Addie got a reputation for being like local heroes. Instead of fleeing the French Quarter, they stayed there and they kind of eked out a living. And they said they actually enjoyed the lack of electricity and watching the stars at night. And apparently they were organizing some relief efforts. And Addie, you know, I've represented a lot of strippers and hookers in my criminal defense practice. She used to flash her breasts to the cops. So the cops used to increase their patrols in the area, not to arrest her, but basically to take a look at Addie's wares. And so everything seemed fine. But then, as the power started coming back on in New Orleans, something happened between Zach and Addie. They started fighting. It got very loud, very aggressive. At one point, Addie pulled a gun on a guy, and then Zach got arrested for a drug charge, and they were evicted from their apartment. So then they moved to the location that you just described, Dave, that where you were at, 826 North Rampart Street. Now, because this is Darkness Radio, I would be remiss if I did not bring this up.
Right.
It just happened to be where they lived. They lived in an apartment in this building above the Voodoo Spiritual Temple in the French Quarter. All right, so they're living above a voodoo temple. And the drinking, the drugs, and the fighting, arguing, between Addie and Zach intensified. And then one day she stopped showing up at her job at this club called the Spotted Cat. What had happened was on Thursday, October 5th, they got into a really bad argument, and Zach strangled her. Then 11 days later, he jumps to his death from the Omni Hotel in New Orleans, and the police find a suicide note in the pocket of his shirt. And it says they need to go, and I'm paraphrasing, to his apartment in the French Quarter, and they will find the remains of her body in the stove, in the oven, in the fridge. He said he burned himself with a cigarette one time for each year that he lived, and the police followed up on the lead and were horrified by what they found. I mean, her head was in a pot on the stove. Other parts of her were...
And it was still slow cooking as well.
It was. He'd even cut up carrots and potatoes and seasoned body parts, and that's why the locals and, of course, the media nicknamed him the Katrina Cannibal. Now, not that this makes it any better, but on the autopsy which was conducted on Zach Bowen, they found no human remains in his stomach, so apparently he hadn't gotten around to eating her yet. But he certainly did everything that would lead one up to believe he was actually
right.
going to commit cannibalism.
Oof. Unbelievable. Now, this Addie, what was Addie's life like before she ended up getting together with Zach? Does it give you much background on her?
Well, from what I can tell, she wasn't exactly the sweet girl next door. She was a tough girl, had been through quite a bit in her life. And she was, you know, although there's no direct proof she was a stripper, basically she was a stripper in New Orleans nightclubs. And, you know, I don't want to knock New Orleans. It's a beautiful city, and it's a fascinating place. But there's some pretty rough aspects to it, and apparently Addie fit right in. And she seems to have been a woman, for the most part, who could handle any type of situation and community, anything that came up from the community. And that's why she and Zach were looked at as the perfect couple. He was the tall, blonde, you know, ex-Army soldier, and she was the sexy vamp type, and they just seemed like it was a good match. But Addie definitely did not come from, I would say, the model family. She'd been around the block a few times, and she definitely was a tough woman, and I think that for the most part she could handle herself even in a barroom brawl.
Now, the other book, as I mentioned, and I don't even want to give the title of it because I don't think it's fair. They really kind of paint her as the protagonist, that it was her constant nudging, edging, and irritating this guy who was dealing with PTSD that led to her demise and the brutal way that it ended. When you're looking through, okay, so it is true that she just kept needling him for this.
Well, she had a long history with other boyfriends for abuse. I don't know if it was so much physical, but it was definitely verbal. Constantly, well, look, they were snorting coke, drinking, and that tends to turn people into the worst versions of themselves. And I guess she started harping on him, criticizing him, and then it got to a point where she started accusing him of cheating on her. And in some of the information that I've been going through, there's a lot of problems in Zach's history. We certainly have the PTSD. He was in Abu Ghraib prison as a guard in Iraq. He did some other things. There was claims that he engaged in some closeted homosexual sex in the military, and that was weighing on him very heavily. He had a lot of guilt from leaving his first wife, and it looked like Addie was, you know, the girl for him, but then all she did is encourage his drug and alcohol abuse. And the problem with the folks suffering from mental disorders like PTSD is self-medicating through drugs and alcohol do not help. All they do is intensify the symptoms and the negative behaviors. So basically, this was a recipe for absolute disaster, except that the disaster was far more gruesome and grotesque than anybody could have possibly imagined.
He cooks this body, leaves it in segments, and now part of it's in the bathtub, part of it's on the oven. I don't really have mediumistic tendencies or psychic abilities, although they're all kind of inert inside of us. It was very strange that Greg and I went into this same area. He was staring into the tub. I just kept staring at the oven and just felt pulled to those segments. And I had no clue. I'd never heard, I'm sure I'd heard the story before, but I had no clue that I was there at the location this took place. So it was, uncanny for me.
Well, first off, Dave, even though you're not a medium, and I've been around you enough in person, you work around so many paranormal phenomenon and with so many people that you're also very open spiritually. And it's not unusual when somebody is in a place like that. Plus, I mean, how many paranormal investigations and ghost hunts have you been on? So, you know, you're a veteran when it comes to this type of activity. However, everybody is capable of picking up on these vibrations. I think you more so because of your experience. And I believe that matter attains vibrations. So in the case of this building on Rampart Street, the oven and the bathtub were the two focal points. The bathtub is where Addie was murdered. The oven, obviously, where she was being cooked, her body parts were, holds residual energy echoes, and you start picking up on this. I don't necessarily believe her spirit was lingering there, although since this time, rumor has it that 826 North Rampart Street is a large focal point of paranormal activity. There's a lot of people who feel that perhaps because they were living above the Voodoo Spiritual Temple, that in some way Zach was possessed by demons or some other malevolent entity. The flip side of the coin is when interviewed about what they do at the Voodoo Spiritual Temple, they said that they are all white magic, white energy, and they have nothing to do with demonic forces. Strangely enough, though, not long after this, the building, the Voodoo Temple, burned down, and they had to, or rather burned enough to where they had to relocate. So now it's, you know, a ghost house and an attraction in that sense. So it is not unusual for people to pick up things like this. One time I was working on a case, and I had to go to a junkyard because my client's car had been badly damaged, and I went out there to take some pictures of it. And all of a sudden, there was a car, like three cars away, and it was wrecked really bad. And I walked up to it, and I just felt that. I just felt somebody had died there. And the guy working in the junkyard walks up to me. He didn't know me from Adam, and he goes, "You can always feel it, can't you?" I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You can tell someone died in that car, can't you?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "We always feel that." I mean, it was really kind of neat that this guy just working in a junkyard says, "Man, when they bring in a car that somebody died in, it kind of feels that way." So I would say that what you were experiencing, Dave, is very normal, and what you were doing is not blocking it. You were saying, "Okay, I'm feeling this, I'm going with it," and you were picking up on the negative energy of the traumatic event which occurred there.
It was bizarre. It was more unnerving afterwards, after the fact, to know that that's where this took place, and we were standing literally in that piece of history. This guy was dealing with inner demons, no doubt. But had he shown a predilection for violence before? I know she had been a part of violent relationships, but had Zach been a part of that?
Well, not per se. I mean, the first time he was arrested was just a couple weeks before they got kicked out of their apartment. He got arrested for drugs. But the question is, what is it that gave him the post-traumatic stress disorder? I mean, he was a U.S. Army sergeant in Iraq, and he spent time at Abu Ghraib you know, which we all know was the prison where Iraqi prisoners were being horribly mistreated. But we also don't know what else he experienced. So there could have been, and was most likely, something in his background that hasn't come to light. So that's why both of these people were essentially damaged goods. And they got together, and once again, this is a Valentine's story, which went the wrong way, that's for sure.
Now, once this is discovered and this case unfolds, they find her body parts. I mean, what is it like for the people in that area? I mean, how are the police? I mean, they've already done, you know, all of this work with the devastating effect of Katrina and the bodies that had to be found. Did they give any indication of how they were handling this?
Well, the police in New Orleans have seen just about everything. And during this period of time and before, Canal Street, which runs adjacent to the French Quarter, was at one time, I don't know if it still is, there was a murder every day on Canal Street. So just on that one street, there was 365 murders per year. However, they're usually shootings or stabbings, not that that makes it, you know, good or anything, but the police that were interviewed said this was unnerving, because this is taking it into a completely different realm. You're seeing a big hulking guy strangling to death a woman literally half his size, and then cutting her up like a turkey, seasoning her and cooking her on a stove. Even for battle-hardened police veterans, this was making these guys sick to their stomachs. And they were horrified by this. So, and then, of course, the people in New Orleans were like, oh, my God. I mean, it's one thing for the typical type of bar fight or violence, but this just went way, way off the scale. The one interesting thing about Zach Bowen, though, Dave, is typically when you have somebody who's murdered and then eaten or prepared to be eaten, the killer, and if you look at like a Jeffrey Dahmer or an Albert Fishes, okay, Albert Fishes lived way back early part of the 20th century, was known as the vampire or the werewolf of Brooklyn, and they, you know, and we all know Jeffrey Dahmer, these people stalked victims down, murdered them, and ate them. And, you know, these are the type of characters where Hannibal Lecter was developed from. You know, fictional characters are oftentimes or generally based on real stories. The problem that police found is that Zach Bowen felt genuine remorse. And they saw from his suicide note, and then when they got to the apartment, what he'd written on the wall in spray paint. And that's where the rumors started coming that maybe he was possessed, because it seemed like the real Zach would never have done this, and that the real Zach was writing the suicide note, was writing the things on the walls, expressing his guilt and remorse, but then the demons were the ones that were controlling him. And so it's very fascinating from that standpoint. And you and I have done many shows where demonic possession as a defense to murder has come up. And as an attorney, I have to mention just for a brief moment about post-traumatic stress disorder being a defense, because it's very, very similar in a court of law to the insanity defense. And for a long time, post-traumatic stress disorder was not even recognized as a legal defense, but it is now. The problem with PTSD is that it tends to be extremely unsuccessful in a court of law as a defense. And also, the reason I'm bringing this up is to sort of, because I know we're getting into the second part of this macabre story, and PTSD will be rearing its interesting head yet again.
It's tragic on so many levels and violent. I mean, with all the cases you've read and looked into, I mean, how does this rate for you as somebody who is very much into the crime and true crime element of your career? I mean, what is this like any other case you've ever really kind of come across?
other than the vampire rapist, but that guy showed zero remorse and guilt. And while I have no sympathy for Zach Bowen, he did realize the consequences of his actions, and he was horrified with them, and that's why he jumped to his own death. I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer certainly didn't do that, neither did Albert Fishes. Right now, I know Netflix is playing the Ted Bundy tapes, and I've watched them back when I was studying criminal law. We did a whole expose, if you will, on Ted Bundy. Honestly, I can't believe one thing that he says on those, because he's trying to say, oh, you know, pornography did this to me. But in the type of murders like this, a sociopath, which is on the lower end of the psychopathic scale, Dahmer, Fishes, Ted Bundy, I mean, we could go on, John Wayne Gacy, they were full-blown psychopaths. I think what happened with Zach Bowen, based on what I'm seeing, is that he was not a psychopath. I think he suffered extremely from an extremely bad case of post-traumatic stress disorder. I think as part of that, he had intense depression, and I think that the cocaine, which would cause a huge surge of energy and impulsive behaviors, and I think alcoholism would only intensify that. I think he basically had a psychotic break, that he completely broke with any semblance of rational behavior, went over the top, killed her. The question is, why then did he start cutting her up and cooking her? Initial theories were that it appeared he was going to be disposing of the body, but then if you're disposing of the body, why are you sautéing it with carrots and potatoes and spices? That's why there's so many unanswered questions here, which to answer your question directly, this is by far one of the most macabre cases I've ever analyzed.
Does he give any other input in the letter of any of what happened, you know, filling in any of the gaps, or is it just a very short, brief, this is where you'll find my girlfriend?
What he said in his suicide note, this is not accidental. I had to take my own life to pay for the one I took. If you send a patrol car to 826 North Rampart, you will find the dismembered corpse of my girlfriend, Addie, in the oven, on the stove, and in the fridge, and a full signed confession from myself, Zach Bowen. I scared myself not by the action of calmly strangling the woman I've loved for 1.5 years and then desecrating her body, but by my entire lack of remorse. I've known forever how horrible of a person I am, ask anyone, and I decided to quit my jobs and spend the $1,500 cash I had being happy until I killed myself. So that's what I did. Good food, good drugs, good strippers, good friends, and any loose ends I may have had. I didn't contact any of my family, so that'll explain the shock, and had a fantastic time living out my days. It's just about time now. The thing is, though, that seems to conflict directly with why he killed himself and the other things that he was writing on the walls. So there is a lot of conflict going on within him. And I think that when he did kill Addie, yes, he had a psychotic break, but I think from there it intensified intensely. And the thing is, his prior behavior to this, aside from alcohol or, you know, drinking a lot and partying and doing some coke, it doesn't seem to indicate this type of violent behavior.
You know, could it be, let's just take a quick look at the Devil Made Me Do It type of scenario. Could it be that there was some kind of dark force within him, and once the murder was done, it released itself from him, leaving him to feel that remorse? Because it's interesting, in the letter he said he just feels no remorse, but yet he realizes he has to give his life for one that he's taken. To me, that's a sign of remorse. That's showing that I know what I did was wrong. There's remorse right there, and that I want to make up for it.
Exactly. That's what doesn't make sense here. He says he has no remorse, yet he's showing signs of guilt and remorse afterwards. Was there a dark force afoot? Well, certainly his own behavior was that dark force. Was it a spiritual entity? Of course, in New Orleans, people say yes. From an objective legal standpoint, that certainly would not stand up in a court of law other than to be considered a form of mental illness. So all we can do, Dave, is lay out the evidence and let the listeners decide.
Right. Like I said, just trying to get a grasp and a handle on how all of this works. All right. So, Tim, I told you this was a twisted story.
Yep.
Right. And you hear this on the whole and you're like, geez, that's brutal. And unfortunately, it's not an isolated case. There are many cases of love gone wrong and these strange murder suicides. We know of one personally that was tragic and heartbreaking that affected our lives. But the fact is, this story doesn't end here.
Okay.
There's a documentary that was being put together. And, Mark, I'll let you take over from here. I mean, this second part of the story gets even, in my opinion, even more weird.
Yeah, it's like the creepiness continues. And then this also, perhaps there were evil spirits permeating this entire case. So because of its bizarre and creepy, macabre nature, Rob Florence, who's a filmmaker, he was so captivated by this that he decided to make a documentary about Addie's murder. And he went into the French Quarter and started asking around, and he found a woman by the name of Margaret Sanchez. And she says, oh, yeah, I was best friends with both Zach and Addie. So Margaret Sanchez ends up being the narrator for this film. I believe it's just called Zach and Addie. And so it's actually a very well-made film, and Rob Florence was, you know, getting ready to do a full-blown release on this, and then all of a sudden he finds out that Margaret Sanchez was implicated in a bizarre murder and dismemberment of a woman by the name of Jaren Lockhart. Now, Jaren, she was an exotic dancer at the Temptation Strip Club in the French Quarter. And the Zach and Addie incident, that occurred back in 2006. Well, now 6 years later, it's June 7th, 2012, and dismembered female body parts start washing up on beaches in Mississippi. A torso on one beach, a head on another, a leg. All right. And so people on the beach are like, oh, my God, you know, they're finding these, and they start calling the police. And, of course, when Jaren Lockhart had been reported missing, this led the police onto the trail, and so they started looking at surveillance videos at Temptation Strip Club, and all of a sudden they see Margaret Sanchez, along with her boyfriend, Terry Speak, on film walking down Bourbon Street with Jaren Lockhart. So this makes them very suspicious, and now Sanchez and Terry Speaks become persons of interest. Well, Terry Speaks right away, it was a prime suspect. He had a terrible criminal history. He was a sex offender, had charges and convictions for assault and battery, and he was a federal fugitive for failing to register as a sex offender, where he allegedly had or was convicted of having relations with a 14-year-old girl. And then on June 12, 2012, just 5 days after the disappearance of Jaren Lockhart, in Tangipahoa Parish in Louisiana, Speaks and Sanchez are pulled over for a routine traffic stop. Now, they certainly weren't being inconspicuous, because Terry Speaks had dyed his hair orange and Margaret Sanchez had dyed her hair blue. Okay, so the cops are like, huh? And he says, now step out of the car. And as soon as Speaks gets out of the car, he takes off running, jumps over a fence, runs into the woods. Well, the police caught him, and then they turned him over to the FBI. And he was extradited to North Carolina and held on $1 million bond, because that's where he apparently was had failed to register as a sex offender. Long story short, Sanchez was held on $35,000 bail, and then it was Terry Speaks went to trial. This guy is a complete nut. He refused to have any counsel, insisted on representing himself, did a horrible job. I mean, there's an old saying, a man who represents himself in court has a fool for a client and a jackass for a lawyer. And he was convicted for the killing and dismemberment of Jaron Lockhart and sentenced to life in prison. Margaret Sanchez went ahead and pled guilty to manslaughter and obstruction of justice, and she was sentenced to 40 years. Now, here's the rub. Because Speaks didn't confess and Sanchez didn't go to trial, we never have gotten the story or the motive behind the killing and dismemberment of Jaron Lockhart. Running a psychological profile on Terry Speaks, he has a long history of mental illness, three failed requests for a mistrial during the proceeding, and he basically made a complete ass of himself in court. Back in the early 90s, he was in the Marines, and he was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. The thing is, if the judge had known that he had borderline personality disorder, he never would have been ruled competent to represent right. himself. And just for the benefit of the listeners, borderline personality is where somebody is on the verge of psychosis and neurosis. So that is the story here, is that Rob Florence making a narrative about Addie and Zach, where Zach murdered, dismembered, and was going to cook, and did cook, and possibly going to eat Addie. He finds her best friend, who's the narrator for his movie, and she ends up murdering and dismembering another woman. I mean, this just gets sicker by the moment.
To have... You've got a woman come on to do the narration for you for part of the story on your documentary, only to have her kind of fall into the exact same weird crime spree. And all of these people, I mean, sometimes it shakes my faith in humanity when you realize just how close you are. And Tim, what have we been doing for about six of the 8 years we've been doing true crime, talking about the I Knew a Murderer?
Yeah, it's been
a long
time.
And here you've got the She Knew a Murderer and then became a murderer and became part of the story as well. Is this, I mean, again, looking at the whole devil made me do it aspect of this, right? I mean, it's pretty bizarre that they're talking about that case and then she ends up being a part of a case very similar in structure and in the way it's represented.
Well, there's a couple different ways looking at this. One, there is the perhaps demonic forces were at work and possessed these people and drove them to do this. And the second is maybe they're just gutter scumbags and birds of a feather flock together. I mean, I don't mean to be cruel, but I mean, come on, look at it. I mean, we got a bunch
right.
of cocaine, drug abusing strippers who have their drunken, mentally unstable boyfriends. And, you know, they live in a place where, you know, people are starting to drink by 10 a.m. You know, this doesn't add up to a nice, clean, white picket fence in the people next
right.
door, although sometimes they're serial killers, too.
Right.
But, you know, we're dealing with a very, very rough crowd here. And these are the type of people that, I mean, they'll pull a knife or a gun on you in a second. One thing I've noticed in working with criminals, both as a prosecutor and as a criminal defense lawyer, is they're not stupid. They may not be college educated, but they certainly are street smart. And while a lot of them are liars, I've encountered several who are extremely truthful, because if they say, I will take this knife and slit your throat, that's what they mean. And so we're dealing with this element. These are very, very rough people. And in the case of Zach Bowen, just because he had not been arrested before, we don't know what he did and of a criminal or violent nature that he was never caught for. Addie and Margaret Sanchez and Terry Speaks, these people were criminals. They were criminals to the fingertips. They lived in an area surrounded by other people just like them, and that type of subculture foments this. On the other hand, there's a lot of people living and working in the French Quarter who are simply doing that, living and working in the French Quarter, and that doesn't make them murderers. So we have to be careful about saying because they live here, because they have these jobs, this is what they do. These people are lowlifes and criminals who happen to live and work there.
Right, but they're lowlifes and criminals who reside there, live there. It's an old voodoo practitioner hall church. You know, it's a spiritual church, things like that. If we don't know what they're calling forth, could, you know, if they're already an unbalanced grouping of people, it would seem like that would be the best for darker forces to be attracted to.
Certainly, because, well, you know, it's people who get involved with Ouija boards, and I know that there's split of opinions. I don't approve of those things, because where do you buy a Ouija board? You buy it in a toy store, okay? And then what's the intention? Hey, you know, you put whip it out at a party, let's have a few drinks and see who we can conjure up. Well, that is not how you approach spirit communication. Spirit communication must be approached with reverence and respect. And as I said in my first book, Never Letting Go, you know, a Ouija board's like throwing a cast net into the cosmos, hoping you're going to catch a nice, happy dolphin. Instead, you pull in a great white shark. And so people that interject themselves into these environments and get involved with all this negativity. Now, maybe it has nothing to do with demonic forces so much as it does with negative energy. And maybe that's tomato or tomato. You know, you know me, Dave. I don't necessarily believe in devils and demons, but I do believe that there's positive energy and negative energy, and that when you invoke negativity and harm and draw that to you, I mean, a negative mind never yields positive results. A negative mind yields negative results. So you can call it demonic possession or negative energy. Unfortunately, the result is often the same.
Yeah. So disturbing in the case that, you know, did any of them try to make a connection to the Zach and Addie thing, saying that they felt influenced by the case, or, you know, trying to grandstand that way?
I know I was looking for that, and I really didn't see any connection there. In fact, Margaret Sanchez, you could tell that she was an experienced criminal because she never said a thing. She never waived her right to remain silent. She kept her mouth shut. And apparently her public defenders cut a deal, even though she got 40 years, it's better than life imprisonment. And so she never confessed. And as part of the plea deal, she was not required to make any type of statement. Whereas Terry Speaks, I mean, he just was a loose cannon right off, right from day one during the trial. And he was claiming that his conviction was appealed, and the Louisiana State Supreme Court denied his appeal and said that basically he needs to stay in prison for life for the murder of Jaron Lockhart. Out of all of this, the person I actually do feel sorry for is Jaron Lockhart. She was only 22 years old. Looking into her history, it was unremarkable. Yeah, she was a stripper, but it's very possible she could have been a runaway or an orphan or abandoned, and she was scratching out an existence best she could in life until she fell into the clutches of these two homicidal maniacs.
You're right. I guess I'm always astounded by the fact that you find one group of killers, but then to find, or, you know, one person that's a killer, but then to find that they're friends with more killers. You're right. They're living in a grouping of people that are probably not the best for all. And I'm not saying all drug dealers and drug addicts are killers, but it certainly puts yourself into a darker category with more desperate people making bad choices that are influenced by drug fueled machinations. Right. I mean, that's where it all comes.
That's true. And speaking of which, this is a momentous day to be doing this particular show, because just a few hours ago, a jury in New York City convicted El Chapo on all counts. Speaking of drug dealers who turned to violence, I mean, El Chapo makes these guys look like kindergarten teachers.
Right.
But the thing about him, I don't know if it was so much sadistic as the nature of the business that he was in. But that's a whole other story for another time. I just thought it was auspicious when I was coming on to do True Crime Tuesday that was the same day that El Chapo, and he's probably the most famous cartel leader since Pablo Escobar.
In cases of relationships gone bad, you know, I mean, I guess I'm old school. Tim and I are of the mind I'd rather just break up with you and never see you again than, you know, have to dissect you, put you into a pot to cook, or, you know, murder you and throw you over a bridge. It just always seems to me like, you know, how do people get in these desperate situations? You can see that, yes, in those cases, they're probably drug-fueled rages, but watching shows like on Investigation ID and Discovery Channel like that, it happens every day that seemingly good people just do horrific things for, you know, money, just for money, or to break up so that they could have another love, you know? And to me, it just, I don't grasp that concept. It's unbelievably hard for me. It's hard breaking up with people. I understand that. And I've been divorced twice. Never at one point did my brain go, might be easier to be a widower than a divorcee. You know, that never crosses my mind. I know our brains just jammed up.
I sat there and talked to these people. It's like, wouldn't it have been easier just to get a divorce? And they're looking at, well, I didn't think of that. Operative word in that response is think. Of course, yeah, divorce is inconvenient. But on the other hand, nobody goes to prison for life for getting divorced. But gee, when, like you said, you cut your spouse up and start baking them and sautéing them. I mean, this is some pretty sick stuff here. And the problem is crimes of passion are as old as humanity itself. I mean, people get angry. Nobody can punch your buttons more than somebody you love. And what people need to understand is that the opposite of love is not hate. It's total indifference. Because hate, like love, requires commitment, emotion, and feeling. So if you're really over somebody, you feel nothing about them. When you think of an ex and start grinding your teeth, okay, then you still have feelings for them. And I think that's what happens, is that in these crimes of passion, there is no semblance of logic. It goes right out the window. I mean, look at it this way. We plan for our careers. We plan for our finances, retirement. It's like, gee, should I buy that car? Can I afford it? You know, we make these logical decisions. But all too often, or always, when it comes to love and attraction, where's the logic? I mean, people talk about chemistry. You see a couple together and say, man, I don't get that one. Where did she find him, and vice versa? And unfortunately, because there's a complete lack of logic when going into a passion and totally emotion-based relationship, when things go sour, well, the smart thing to do is to break up and be equitable about it. Even if you don't like each other, get divorced. Or if you take it to the extreme, you end up on a pot on a stove in the French Quarter.
Yeah, love is a weird thing. Relationships are weird. People are bizarre. The whole concept of murder for profit, murder for, you know, just frustration. It just seems like there's so much more for people to just walk away than there is for them to engage in murderous activity.
Well, that's the intelligent and the logical thing to do. I remember one of my
But we're all one bad day away from being that person, right? We're all pretty much one bad day from probably being somebody that could take a life.
Dave, it would be easy to say, oh, no, not me. But we all have, we can all get to the point where we're so tired, so frustrated, so mentally exhausted, and so angry that you can snap. And I'm not justifying this. That's where the legal defense of temporary insanity comes in. Because an insane person certainly would be like Terry Speaks with his history of sex offense and all of this nonsense. But for, you know, a mild-mannered John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public to completely lose any semblance of control. It can happen to everybody. And, you know, that old saying, walk away and count to 10, there's a lot to that because it's like shaken baby syndrome. You know, nobody wants to hurt a baby, a defenseless, beautiful little baby, but you get so angry, you hold the baby and you shake the baby until he or she stops crying. Not because you're damaging their brain. And something like shaken baby syndrome, nice people can do that. And so that's why it's so important to, if you're beginning to lose your temper, take a step away, count to 10, call somebody. Unfortunately, and I'm not making excuses for Zach or Addie, apparently there was nobody who cared enough for them to call. But I think that what was going on with them was way beyond that. And Margaret Sanchez and Terry Speaks, unlike Zach Bowen, to me, it feels like they planned this. Now, what's really fascinating, Crossroads Behavioral Health in Louisiana said back in 2010 of this murdered, they consulted with Hancock County Sheriff's Office, and they said that there was a possible motive in the killing of Jaron Lockhart, that it was a ritual of sacrifice performed for magical purposes because the planet Venus had crossed between the Earth and the Sun on the date of Lockhart's death, an astral event that occurred only once in the previous two centuries and will not happen again until 2117. Now, that's an interesting theory, but when I was looking into their backgrounds, I'm not seeing anything about either of them that indicates that they were involved in magic or voodoo or astrology. Whereas, if that had been part of the murder involving Zach and Addie, it may have had some credence simply because they did live above the voodoo spiritual temple. So there are so many unanswered questions in both of these cases, but in the case of Zach and Addie, they're both physically gone from this world, and with Margaret Sanchez and Terry Speaks, they have been removed for society, hopefully forever.
Well, I thank you so much. I know it's never easy, especially to just kind of come in on this and being a sensitive. I mean, when you start examining a case like this, do you ever open up psychically to that side to see, you know, to get some information from it? Or is it, you know, in a case this gruesome, is it something you just try to avoid that part of who you are?
On this one, I kept my shields up. I remember when you asked me to look into the DNA evidence on the Clutter murder in Kansas, the
right.
Cold blood, that one really got to me, and I actually started feeling the presence of the murder victims around me. I remember that one really, really touched me because that they were just a nice family that fell prey to these those two maniacs. But in this situation, I kept my defenses up, and I wanted to look at it legally and then also try to understand if there were any spiritual motives. And the whole thing about the ritual sacrifice, while it's interesting, there's nothing to support that. I think the sheriffs were just grasping at straws, honestly, because they were trying to justify why would these two people murder and dismember a woman like that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us here. And we hope you have a much more happy and uplifting week and can shake this off your shoulders. Mark, thank you for doing this and always delivering whatever what we're looking for.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Tim. And to all the listeners, keep tuning in to Darkness Radio.
Hey, how can people find out where you're going to be, what you're doing, and when you're coming to their town?
Well, I got a lot going on this year. I got the We Don't Die Orlando Afterlife Conference coming up between March 28th and the 31st. And if people want to find out about my tour schedule, because I'm going to be all over the country this year, please go to my website, evidenceofeternity.com, just like my book, Evidence of Eternity, and please sign up for my newsletter. and follow me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And Dave, I can't thank you enough, Dave and Tim, for having me on the show. Thank you, and many blessings to everyone. Have a happy Valentine's Day. And if you get mad at your partner, walk away.
Amen. All right. It's time now to kick open the case files. You know what it means. Dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Tim, I always love when we have Mark Anthony on. Again, I can't even stress enough. The guy was totally unfamiliar with this case a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, you know what? I need this story. And I want it all reviewed and looked at, researched. And man, he delivers every time. What a freaky, weird story with twists and turns, man.
Absolutely. Just bizarre. Bizarre.
Speaking of twists and turns, Timmy D, it's time for us to take a look at the dumb crimes and stupid criminals from this past week. And there are many. Many strange stories, okay. Including this fun little headline.
All right.
U.S. student who electrocuted his nipples sues teacher for not warning him that it would be dangerous.
Well, why wouldn't it be?
An American student whose heart stopped after he deliberately electrocuted himself in a science class is suing his teacher for not warning him it was dangerous. Kyle Dubois, age 18, is also taking legal action against the school district and the city of Dover in New Hampshire. Dubois and his parents claim teacher Thomas Kelly did not tell him and other students of the dangers of the demonstration power cords in their electrical trades class. Shouldn't that just be known, especially by the time you make it to high school?
Yeah, I would think electricity hurts is one of the things you would learn in your curriculum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're seeking compensation for medical expenses, lost income due to time away from work, and other damages related to the incident. Dubois attached an electrical clamp to one nipple while another student attached another clamp to the other. A third student plugged in the cord. Well, there's the two people you sue. Dumb one and dumb two that clamped them on your nipples and plugged you in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dubois attached an electrical clamp to one nipple while the other student attached it to another, and then a third student plugged in the cord. Dubois was critically injured, and his legal team claim he was suffered permanent brain damage. I think he had already suffered that at birth. He was initially taken to Wentworth Douglas Hospital, where he was diagnosed as having an out-of-hospital electrocution resulting in cardiac arrest, unresponsive state, and respiratory failure, according to the lawsuit. He was later taken to Massachusetts General Hospital, where doctors drilled a hole in his skull in order to insert a probe to monitor the pressure on his brain. The lawsuit alleges Mr. Kelly knew that his students were doing and claims one student heard Mr. Kelly state that Kyle should try it with his nipples and that he, Mr. Kelly, would give him a Mountain Dew if he did so.
Oh, no.
Oh, all right. That's bad. Several students reportedly told police Mr. Kelly was involved in the dare, but confusingly, Dubois has since defended his teacher and claimed it was a fellow student who challenged him and offered him the drink. Attaboy. Way to be an upstanding kid for a moron. Who electrocuted himself, but way to be an upstanding kid. Mr. Kelly resigned about a month after the incident and has declined to comment on this matter. Police have filed no criminal charges in the investigation.
See, let's balance one wrong with another here, Dave. This is why you let your kids experiment with S&M at an early age, because if they did, they'd know that nipple clamps and hooked up to batteries are actually a bad thing. And it hurts and electrocutes, and they probably shouldn't mess with it in shop anyways.
Well, talking about kids, Tim, and allowing your children to experiment and learn things, this man wants to sue his parents for giving birth to him without his consent as part of an antinatalist movement that says having children is just morally wrong.
What?
A man is planning to sue his parents in India for giving birth to him without his consent. Raphael Samuel said he had a great relationship with his parents, but he has compared having children to kidnapping and slavery. The 27-year-old Mumbai is an antinatalist who believes it is wrong to put an unwilling child through the rigmarole of life for the pleasure of its parents. The antinatalist movement is gaining traction in India as younger people resist social pressure to have children. Speaking to the Prince Samuel said, "I love my parents and we have a great relationship, but they had me for their joy and their pleasure. Mm-hmm. My life has been amazing, but I don't see why I should put another life through the rigmarole of school and finding a career, especially when they didn't even ask to exist."
Hmm.
Samuel runs a Facebook page called Nihilianand, which has hundreds of followers, on which he regularly posts antinatalist material. One image is captioned, "Parents are hypocrites," with the text saying, "A good parent puts the child above its wants and needs, but the child itself is a want to the parent." Some antinatalist activists in India also argue that having children is a strain on Earth's resources and avoid procreation for environmental reasons. Another activist, Pradama Nayak, said, "We don't want to impose our beliefs on anyone, but more people need to consider why having a child in the world is right and why you shouldn't do it right now." His page, entitled Child Free India, wrote last month, "Should we continue to bring more children into the world and accelerate the process of environmental and social degradation? Do you think existence is pain and not bringing a child into this world is a guaranteed way to avoid unnecessary suffering for the child?" I think, with this lawsuit in motion, they should seriously contact legal teams and see if it's too late to abort this adult jackass.
Well, I can't argue with that. I mean, there's some people, sure, that probably shouldn't procreate.
No. There's a lot of people that should.
He's got a half a point here. A full point, maybe not.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Crazy. Ah, Tim, we're coming up. It's Valentine's Day in just a few days.
Sure.
You know, we just shared a romantic love story.
You and I?
For our crime. No, today's crime.
Of course, nothing says love
like cannibalism, right? But
right.
Tim, here's a story that it might be the feel-good story of the week.
Okay.
All right. We're going to Willingboro, Pennsylvania. Wedding bliss was short-lived for a New Jersey groom who allegedly sexually assaulted a waitress at his reception before getting into a brawl with the police. Recently married Matthew Amers, age 31, approached a waitress who was underage at his November 2018 wedding reception at the Northampton Valley Country Club in Northampton Township, according to the court documents. He allegedly first propositioned her by asking her to go outside and make out and telling her she could do anything she wanted with him. Oh, there's an offer, Tim.
Jeez.
I'll tell you what. We can go outside and you can do whatever you want. This guy, it's not like he looks like Brad Pitt or something where you might be like, oh, I'd tear that up.
Even Brad Pitt's having some issues these days. I mean,
kind of looks more like Aaron Paul from Breaking Bad's slightly handicapped brother.
Yikes.
That would be my guess. Yeah, she rejected his advances. Hard to believe when you're given all that. Do whatever you want to me.
Yeah.
So according to police, he then followed her into a bathroom, pulled her into an empty stall, and then exposed himself. While in the bathroom, he allegedly offered her $100 to kiss me like you mean it, and he pressed his penis against her pants before she managed to get away from him.
Not exactly Don Juan.
No. Following the alleged assault, police responded to a call from the country club. An employee of the club told officer that Amers started throwing punches and pushing people after he tried to stop him from bringing alcohol outside the venue, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Amers also got into a fight with police officers before being taken into custody, according to court documents. He has been charged with simple assault, disorderly conduct, and resisting arrest. Amers' attorney said that his client maintains his innocence and looks forward to clearing his name when all is concluded. He was released Wednesday on $350,000 bond.
Couldn't be enough.
And is next due in court on February 21st. On your wedding day, buddy.
Yeah.
On your wedding day.
I think the shopping's pretty much done at that point.
Yeah. Exciting and new, unless she stands by him. I'll stand by you.
Unless she's shopping with him, unless it's a tandem shopping trip. There's no reason to be doing that deal. Yeah.
I got a food story for you here, Tim.
Oh, speaking of food, yeah.
We're going to the Bronx, buddy.
Oh, the Bronx.
Where you kind of almost expect a story like this.
Mm-hmm.
A Bronx restaurant runs out of beef patties and an angry woman smashes its windows with a bat.
Mm.
I got to admit, when I get the meat cravings, Tim.
Yeah.
just get out of my way. Yeah. Hand me a meat stick or lay down and pretend to be dead. It's your safest option. Talk about hangry, Tim. A woman went on a rampage in the Bronx all over a beef patty. Police released video showing the woman smash the restaurant's windows with a bat. And looking at her, Tim, we might consider signing her to the Twins.
Yeah.
Because every shot is head on and powerful enough to shatter glass.
Atta girl.
Can we sign her up?
I think we can. I mean, we have gotten a few free agents, but the pole ads are notoriously cheap. So, yeah, we could.
Well, I'm guessing they could pay her in patties, meat patties. Just keep her on the dole with meat patties,
yeah.
Tim.
Well, yeah, they would. They'd more than willingly do that. Yeah.
This happened at the Back Home restaurant on 169th Street in Claremont. Police said she was angry because the restaurant was out of beef patties. Where's the beef? Luckily, nobody was injured.
Clara
Police
Peller?
Are still searching for the suspect, though.
Well, you just said it was Clara Peller.
Right. She's been dead about 20 years, though.
Yeah.
Were the beef patties worth the beef, according to one Yelp review? They are, without a doubt, the best beef patties they have ever eaten. All makes sense.
I don't know if you've eaten your way around New York, Dave, but most of them are. I'd take a bat and start smashing windows and restaurants and food places in New York. I would.
That's why you and I don't dine out when we go out of town together, because you're a rampaging lunatic. But just at, like, you know, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, 11 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, if I need meat, just shut up and make me a sandwich or something. That's the best way to survive in my life.
Yeah.
Meat! I hate when you're craving meat and somebody offers you, well, you want a Pop-Tart?
No.
Is it a meat Pop-Tart?
No.
You want to make you some eggs? Yes, with sausage and bacon. We don't have any sausage and bacon. Well, I want meat. What part of meat don't you understand? Oh, yeah. You want to make you a nice warm cup of cocoa and some cookies? It's not meat, but I'll take that too. Yeah, the incident strikes similarities to a man's rampage at a Brooklyn deli back in November. In the video, the man demanded that workers make his toasted cinnamon raisin bagel with bacon, egg, and cheese right now.
Oh, yeah.
You know who this beef basher is, Tim. We need your help. Call Crime Stoppers. 1-800-577-TIPS, Tim. I said T-I-P-S, TIPS.
Oh, TIPS. Right.
That's 1-800-577-8477. 1-800-577-TIPS. 8477. That's what it stands for, Tim.
Although I did dial the other one the other day and had a very interesting conversation.
Did you? Were you forced to give the phone number first?
Or
your credit card?
I was, and it cost me about $853.
Wow.
Very embarrassing. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's the beef right there.
Yep.
Well, as long as we're talking food and aggression, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
For the second time in as many weeks, a Florida man, what a surprise, has been arrested for battering a woman with a burrito. You heard that right, Tim. For the second time in as many as 2 weeks, Florida man is arrested for battering a woman with a burrito.
Well, no wonder he went to jail.
Yeah. Police charge it Peter Alacqua, 41, got into an argument with his girlfriend Friday in their Port Richey residence. After Alacqua allegedly shoved the woman into a chair in the bedroom, he threw his burrito at the victim, striking her in the face with the food item. I bet there's porn sites for that.
I was going to say, you know, in college, I used to think going up to a woman and telling her I wanted to batter her with my burrito was a pickup line, but evidently not. No.
Nowadays, it gets you arrested.
It will. Yeah, it will.
Who was it? There was some actor who used to like you to throw like pineapple slices at his bare ass.
That was a Led Zeppelin thing. The bologna against the bare butt was a Led Zeppelin thing. They used to do cold cuts.
Really?
Yeah, that was a Led Zeppelin thing.
No, but there was also it might have been Paul Lynde. I remember reading somewhere. It was an outwardly gay man, and his predilection was to have like fruit thrown at his butt.
That might be.
But now I'm compelled to know more about this Led Zeppelin story. So who would Jimmy have to like smack Robert in the bottom with a slice of bologna?
No. They did it with groupies. So they would have a groupie line up and they'd have them like in the hotel room. They'd get them in the hotel room.
It was like
a
ring toss?
Kind of. What they would do is they would get the woman to pull her panties down and she would kind of like she was being frisked, get up against the wall, and they would take sounds very embarrassing, I know, and I'm not encouraging the kids out there to do this, but they would take cold cuts or bologna, and they would stand at a couple of paces, and they would have contests to see who could hit the woman in the buttocks with either bologna or
was it winner take all?
It was a heated competition. Yeah.
Weird. You know, yeah. I've been really into these autobiographies on Audible lately, right? So mm-hmm. I've been powering through a lot of musicians, and I just did Roger Daltrey's The Who, right? Mm-hmm. So I listened to Billy Idol, who's got a very good reading voice.
Yeah.
And then you talk to Roger Daltrey, who's telling us stories about being out of The Who. And it's just so disturbing. But he tells some great stories. And then he was talking about their first song that they put out there, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That they weren't getting the sound they wanted. And they had to, Pete had to step aside so that they could get another musician to play the guitar riff. And they were all put out by who they had to get, because it was this young upstart that nobody cares about, Jimmy Page.
Oh, right. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I can't explain. That was their big hit.
Mm-hmm.
So in the original recordings of that, that's Jimmy Page playing the guitar.
Yep. He did a lot of session work for Led Zeppelin.
Oh, man, we got to settle with that Page kid again.
Yep.
He's going nowhere quick.
I did forget one disturbing part of the bologna, a.k.a. cold cut deal. Well, I didn't know if it's a little racy for True Crime Tuesday. Well, we do.
What? We just, what?
I know, but here's the part that's a little extreme is if the cold cuts were having a hard time sticking, they may use a foreign substance such as a spread, Dave, a spread to affix
mayonnaise, if you would.
Yes, they would either use mayonnaise or
something else. Yeah.
Yeah. To
all
affix.
Right. Well, I guess this woman's story doesn't sound so bad after all, then. I kid. How gross. Right.
Yeah.
So the woman, when a sheriff's deputy arrived at the home in response to the 911 call, the woman had the contents of the burrito dispersed across her face, neck, and left chest shoulder area. Oh, it was a big burrito.
That's what she said.
Alacqua fled from the area before cops arrived and refused to return home when contacted on his cell phone. He subsequently turned his phone off, and no further contact was made. Police eventually caught up with Alacqua yesterday afternoon, Tim. So the burrito basher is now in custody on a misdemeanor domestic battery charge. He was booked into custody. Wouldn't evading police also be a thing they should have thrown at him?
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah. He was booked into the county jail in advance of a court hearing. Alacqua's rap sheet includes prior arrests for cocaine, aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, methamphetamine possession, domestic battery, violating probation, and possession of drug paraphernalia. On January 27th, police arrested Floridian Victor Foster, 49, for allegedly striking his wife in the face with a Taco Bell burrito.
Oh, my.
That's a waste right there. Don't ever do that. Don't hit people in the face with burritos, for God's sakes.
It's either hit them in the face with Taco Bell or just pick it up and throw it in the toilet. Either way, it's not
really staying in you very long. Exactly. That's folks show. Yeah. I do love Taco Bell. It's crack-like addiction.
Hmm.
Tim.
Yeah.
It's time for swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice. Are you ready?
I was supposed to do something after that, but I've had a concussion and now I can't remember. There's somebody at home that does something after you do swift justice. Oh, I know. I'm supposed to go Ricola.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, because once you said Swiss justice when you went to say swift justice.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
It still doesn't make any sense at all. Hey, here's three, not one, not two, but three stories, Tim, of swift justice. Swift justice. Swift justice.
Ricola.
Stop it.
Oh, okay.
We're going to Texas City, Texas, the redundant city and state, Tim.
Okay.
Police say a Texas woman used her granddaughter's scooter to defend herself against a pair of machete-wielding men wearing clown masks who attempted to rob the woman and her husband. Police say Aretha Cardinal and her husband Joseph Nelson were in the driveway of their Texas City home last week when the masked men approached and placed a machete to Nelson's throat.
Ooh.
Authorities say Nelson wrestled away the machete from one man while Cardinal grabbed the child's scooter from the driveway and used it to strike the other man. Nelson tells Houston television stations KTRK, the men tried to run away, but the couple chased them, smashing their vehicle window with the scooter. The two suspects have been jailed on aggravated robbery charges. Don't mess with the elderly, son.
No, you don't.
Balk. No.
They have that weird old man and old woman strength that is just bizarre.
What's that, Tim? You want another story of swift justice?
Yes, please.
Swift justice. Swift justice.
Swiss We're going Miss to... Instant
no.
Coco.
No, no, no. Philadelphia. Oh. WPVI, the Pivy, Tim.
The Pivy?
Yeah. An alleged thief may have thought he was pulling a fast one on a local college student by grabbing his stuff and running. As it turns out, he wasn't fast enough to get away from some accidental Crime Stoppers, Tim.
Ew.
As it turns out, the Annenberg Lunchtime Running Club is not a running vigilante group. It's a group of students at the University of Pennsylvania or people in the area just trying to exercise. Mm-hmm. But their running skills were put to the test when they heard student and Antoine Hayward shout on campus. Antoine Hayward shout on campus. I said, yo, like, get the guy, recounts Haywood. Police say the guy was 26-year-old Talib Adams. He was accused of stealing a laptop and cell phone from a man on campus. It was sort of a shared look among the four of us there, and it was like we got to do what we can, said Natalie Herbert, a PhD candidate and runner. Herbert was part of the four in the group who chased Adams down. We had the benefit of strength in numbers running in a place we felt very safe running in because we were around campus, said Herbert. Or Hébert, not sure if it's one of those fancy French names.
Could be.
But the chase led them far from the Annenberg School of Communication, where the group meets, to a construction site on the 37th and Chestnut, Tim. There was a lot of it was like a movie, said Kyle Cassidy, who helped track down the suspect. The construction workers were saying, you can't go in there. It's a construction site. And inside the construction site, there's earth movers moving earth and things pounding and sparks flying and cement. That's where Penn police were able to catch up with the suspect. The victim was able to get his belongings back. Just seeing that happen is like more real. So just keeping my belongings, whether it's in the library or wherever, Hayward said. Not sure I understand any of that.
Mm.
Adams is being charged with three felonies, including criminal trespassing.
Hmm.
How about that? You steal from somebody, and it just so happens that you have a vigilante group of runners.
It's the running high, I think. It just makes them all crazy and nuts and all vigilante-like.
Vigilante-like?
Yes, vigilante-like.
Tim.
Yes.
This is our third case of swift justice. Swift justice. That's the kind that we're talking about right here, Tim. An inmate falls through a ceiling trying to escape from jail. Tim, did you hear that story?
I heard that, yeah.
This one's in Brownstown, Indiana. No Florida stories in these swift justice cases. Jeez. An inmate fell through the ceiling while trying to escape from a jail in Indiana. Jackson County Sheriff Rick Meyer posted on Facebook that 28-year-old Blaze Ayers bolted from officers and locked himself in a medical room on Monday. When officers got into the room, Ayers had made his way into the ceiling tiles. The sheriff says Ayers eventually fell through the ceiling and onto the floor of the jail's booking area. Officers used a stun gun to subdue him after he refused to surrender. Never surrender.
No,
never surrender. The sheriff says the attempted escape caused extensive damage to the ceiling. Ayers was treated for minor injuries and is charged with attempted escape and criminal mischief. You know those kids always up to mischief, Tim?
Oh, yeah. It's in their DNA. Yeah.
Huh. I don't understand why that opened up a page for me on women's sexy hollow body con V-neck long sleeve evening cocktail party dresses on Facebook.
Well,
or I mean on eBay.
Well, I mean, you know,
they are sexy, and I don't know if it's Facebook telling me I could dress up a little bit better, or I'm sorry, eBay telling me I could dress a little better for these interviews.
Could be.
But woman's sexy hollow body con V-neck long sleeve evening cocktail party dress with tags, only $9.99.
That's pretty.
There's
good.
The real crime,
that's,
Tim.
That's a good price, Dave. I would jump on that. But,
yeah.
It's always dress for the job you want, Dave. Dress for the job you want.
Not dress for the job you're with. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. In this next story, Tim, we're with the OPP.
Yeah, you know me, yeah.
No, I'm serious. We're with the OPP.
What, OP?
No, OPP.
Oh.
Rideau Lakes OPP officers were called to break up a bingo brawl Tuesday after two seniors got into a physical struggle over seating during a game.
That figures.
And other residents at the old age home, then piled on. Officers responded to the fight between the two women, age 79 and 86, at the unidentified long-term care facility in Rideau Lakes Township at about 1:15. No one was seriously injured or hurt. No charges were placed, police said.
It's because you can't throw a punch with all that osteoporosis. That's why.
Yeah, I've got one really old cat who is kind of the mother matronly cat in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And when she squares off, she's like taekwondoing their asses because mm-hmm. everything's in these slow or tai chi. She's doing these like super slow movements.
Oh, yes.
And she'll hit them, but like in slow motion. And the other cats are like, what are you doing? And that's kind of what I've envisioned. Just these two old women. And then they just both fall to the ground.
Yeah, but gently. Yeah, because you don't want to break a hip. Yeah.
But you don't have to worry, Tim, because the OPP were there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
To break things up.
Well, they, yeah. But gently, because you don't want to break a hip. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I can get into this story because it's part of the Washington Post.
Oh, and they always want money from me. Yeah, that's a Jeff Bezos thing. It's like, I own Amazon. I have $180 billion, but here, I want your 99 cents to access my article. What the hell's that all about? It's bad enough we pay for Prime and we pay this huge amount so you can ship me my iced tea, you know, for...
God, screw it. I'm going to go straight to Newser for the story.
All right. Yeah, do that.
Screw you, Washington Post.
Yeah, screw you, Bezos.
We're not putting any more of our advertising dollars in with you.
That's right. I don't want
to
see.
We've never put any in, but we're never going to now.
Yeah, well, I don't want to see your peen anyways. I don't care if the National Enquirer shows me. I don't know. Well, haven't you been following that story?
I don't know. I don't want to know. Florida politician resigns after face-licking scandal. Florida Commission on Ethics found Nancy Oakley licked the city manager's face back in 2012. Yeah. Way to show how quickly the government works on solving these problems. I just hope we can all come together and be a quaint little fishing village we used to be. So says the mayor of Merida Beach, Florida. Madeira Beach, Florida. Tim, I'm going to go with that one now. In the wake of an odd political scandal that has become national news, City Commissioner Nancy Oakley tendered her resignation Tuesday, the day before the City Commission censured her for her publicly licking a former city manager's face, reports the Tampa Bay Times. The Florida Commission on Ethics determined that Oakley had violated the state's ethics rules after investigating a complaint filed by the former city manager, Shane Crawford. The incident dates to a meeting held back in November of 2012. During a fishing tournament in the town of 4500, Oakley had admitted to drinking during the tournament. The details are still a bit convoluted, but Oakley took issue with the presence of Crawford's executive assistant, Cheryl McGrady. McGrady had been tasked with taking the meeting's minutes. Oakley suspected she and Crawford were having an affair. They deny this. The two later married, though. And using obscenities demanded McGrady be removed from the meeting. Another city employee stepped in to take minutes. The meeting occurred, and then Oakley approached Crawford and licked him from his Adam's apple up the left side of his face, Tim.
Damn, she freaky deaky.
You've had to pay good money to have that happen.
Weekly.
She then groped him and attempted to punch McGrady, who told her she was being inappropriate. Crawford filed the complaint in 2017 when Oakley decided to run for re-election. Oakley maintains the incident never occurred, but says she'll resign to still the controversy. WFTS notes that the sponsor of the 2012 fishing tourney alleged that his face had been licked by Oakley at other tournaments and that she had done the same to volunteers. Oh, it was just a fun little way of showing you care. That's all.
Why don't they do that in Minnesota fishing tournaments? That's what I want to know. I'd go to more fishing tournaments.
Yeah, I don't know.
I really would.
Should we sign people up for that? If you want to join this fishing tournament and lick Tim's face, we've got the gig for you.
Yeah.
What? Yeah,
I would go to more fishing tournaments.
Would you?
Instead, it's like, you know, you go to Minnesota fishing tournaments and it's like, get a Zebco rod and reel with a brand new bobber. That's your first place.
A new bobber.
A new bobber, you know. Oh. That'll be swell. And second place is a pizza from around the corner. And third place is a roast.
A roast.
Good luck to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a story. I don't know if you want to call the story swift justice. I mean, I guess something bad was happening and something good came from it. How about that?
Okay.
Is that okay, Tim?
That'll work.
Listen, you know, I know you love animals. You love dogs. You love cats. You love guinea pigs. You love hamsters and maybe gerbils a little too much. But
hey,
you love animals, Tim.
Yeah, I do.
And there is a kitty cat in need of a forever home. Now, you know, I would take it, but the Schrader household is filled. We have five cats and six kids, two adults, and a partridge in a pear tree. But Houston, Texas needs a forever home for a cuddly little kitty, Tim.
Oh, I thought the whole city needed a forever home, the way you put it there.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. All's well that ends well. Though the outcome of an abandoned Texas home could have been a little different. Per KTRK, the track, Tim, authorities say someone busted into the Houston abode earlier this month so they could smoke some pot.
Oh. So
they broke into this abandoned home to smoke a little bit of the ganj, Tim, a little bit of the weed.
They're industrious.
Some of the devil's lettuce, Satan's cabbage, Tim. What are some of the other euphemisms we like to use? Some of Willie Nelson's lawn clippings.
Yes, Willie Nelson's lawn clippings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he was when he's wandering around the house smoking pot, he found something.
What did he find?
In an unlocked rinky-dink cage, a full-grown adult tiger.
Oh, geez.
The cage was kept in a garage that was held closed with a nylon strap and a screwdriver, police say. The concerned citizen then called 311 to report the big cat. And we questioned them as to whether they were under the influence of the drugs or they were actually seeing a tiger. That's a sergeant with the Houston Police Department's Animal Cruelty Unit tells KTRK, the Trek. Or is it the Turk? I don't know.
Could be the Turk.
Cops converged on the home Monday with a warrant and did indeed find the tiger, who they say was living in deplorable conditions with a few packages of meat left alongside her, Tim.
Is his name Tony?
No, it's a she. Oh. They said left alongside her, Tim. Could the tiger was said to be a good-natured and generally healthy, but police tranquilized her so that they could move her to a nearby animal shelter for now. Unfortunately, the Houston Zoo can't accommodate her, so they're trying to find her a forever home, Tim. It's not easy finding a forever home for a full-grown tiger. They're wild animals, and sometimes they can get aggressive. But, Tim, I think you're man enough to control them, like King Ezekiel from The Walking Dead. I think you're man enough to take care of this kitty, Tim. And I'll just, you know what? If anybody in the Houston area is willing to transport the tiger, you can take it right to Tim's house over at 314.
Dave.
What?
I'm going
to. I'm trying to get it there to you free, Tim. So if you just drop it off at 314.
Dave.
What? What's that?
Let me point something out to you real quick.
Before
we start giving out addresses willy-nilly here.
Okay, sure.
Let's think about this for a second, this whole scenario. Let's rewind real quick.
Right. Chicks, did I mention that Mike Tyson has tigers and chicks dig it?
Right, right. But let's consider Mike Tyson's stature. Right? Mike Tyson.
I think he's 6 feet tall.
Right. Okay. So he's already got an inch or two on me. Okay. Mike Tyson, big burly fighter, could probably punch that tiger out with one hand if he had to.
You can just love it to death, Tim.
But Dave, let's pump those brakes for a minute.
Wow.
Here's the deal. Timmy can't run from the tiger. If Timmy,
you heard it here, folks. Tim hates animals.
No.
He despises animals and refuses to give his home up to a forever home to a poor little feline in need.
I could love that tiger, but the minute that tiger loves me and it's dinner time and Timmy runs out of food and Timmy becomes that food, Timmy can't get away fast enough. So, it's probably
you have a lot. You were telling me you have a lot of annoying neighborhood kids, Tim. There's a food source. They'll never run out.
When the first kid goes missing.
Well, how about if they just drive by and let you pet them, see if it's a good match at 314.
Dave.
No.
Yeah. In Minnesota, we have very stringent animal rules. Once you take on a pet, you have to keep that pet for good. You just can't give the pet away. And I wouldn't want to do that to that poor pet.
Be its forever home, Tim. Be the cuddly man you could be.
Dave, I don't think I'm physically able to take on a pet of that size. Dave, so
think about it. That when the zombie apocalypse rises, you'll be the King Ezekiel.
I know it's very, very expensive to take on a tiger, Dave. I know that Floyd Money Mayweather doesn't have anything going on right now, and he's got a whole lot of money.
Wow, Tim.
And he's closer in location, so I think it'd probably be in his best interest.
I'm sorry, folks. I'm just as disappointed as you all that Tim has just shown his disdain and complete
hatred
for all animals.
I love tigers. I'd like one of those miniature tigers, like those mini pigs.
No, you don't. You just want a monkey that will bring you things.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you offered. Do you have one?
Yeah.
Do you have a little capuchin monkey?
But if anybody out there does, bring it to Tim's house at 314.
No. Just email me.
What? You just said you wanted a monkey, man.
Yeah,
how can I make this work if you're not willing to work with me?
But you can email me first and let me know if you actually have one. Send pictures. Make sure it has all its shots. You've manicured the thing and maybe defanged it or something. I'm not sure. But you can email me at tim@darknessradio.com and make sure that everything is set up properly.
Oh, my God, dude.
I got to know.
Here's a story. This is from like 2 weeks ago. Hold on.
Okay.
Hold on.
All right.
2 weeks ago, I hate watching the Vikings lose. I mean, it like brings up my ire.
Right.
Bubbles my tummy. I get very angry.
Oh, I know you do. I've seen you kick your dog many times after the Vikings have lost.
No.
Oh, that poor dog just
dogs, Tim. I'm
flies
weird.
Across the room and hits a wall. And
you are so
poor thing.
You're going to feel bad after I read the story. You bring that up. Okay. Police say a woman upset about the Philadelphia Eagles' loss to the New Orleans Saints got into an argument with her girlfriend. And put the girlfriend's dog in a microwave.
Oh, God. Okay, I'm sorry.
Kirsten Gaskins of Philadelphia faces charges including assault, harassment, and cruelty to animals. The alleged incident occurred at a hotel in Hanover Township. Gaskins, 31, began yelling at the woman about the Eagles' 20-14 loss to New Orleans in Sunday's playoff game a few weeks ago. During the altercation, Gaskins allegedly struck the victim several times, causing visible injury. She also allegedly threatened to kill the victim's dog and stuck it in the microwave. When police arrived, they found out the white Pomeranian was still in the microwave. The device, thankfully, had not been turned on, and the dog appeared to be okay. Gaskins was released on $20,000 bail. It wasn't immediately known if she'd retained an attorney. That, you know, with Valentine's around the corner, that's love gone bad right there, Tim.
And that's why, Dave, again, people are trying to tell me last year when the Eagles were making their run at the Super Bowl, I tried to tell them that Eagles fans weren't right in the head.
Wow.
And people were like,
see, did you hear that, folks? He hates tigers and eagles.
No.
And anybody that loves eagles, the bird of our country. Our final story.
Oh, God.
Sumter, South Carolina. Uh-huh. Carolina? South Carolina?
South Carolina.
A sheriff's office in South Carolina says a Sumter teen faked his own kidnapping and led his mother to believe he'd been killed if she didn't pay $130. That's all.
No, that's
all they needed. The Sumter County Sheriff's Office tells news outlets that the 19-year-old Emmanuel Franklin was arrested Sunday and charged with blackmail. Deputies say Franklin led his mother to believe he had been abducted this month and would be killed unless $130 in small unmarked bills were placed in a nearby neighborhood mailbox. An incident report says the mailbox belonged to Franklin's father. Franklin's mother told deputies she received a call from Franklin and an unknown man from a private number, and the unknown man demanded the cash or Franklin would be hurt. Deputies say later Franklin told authorities he made up the story to get money from his mom.
Wah, wah.
Cheering. What can you do? That's it for this week, kids. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this is True Crime Tuesday.